21 minutes to 7 o'clock. A very good morning if you aren't just joining us on Weekend Breakfast. Great to have you along for the ride. Now, we all know that good sleep is important for good health, mental and physical. So if you are one of the millions of people globally affected by poor sleep or sleep disorder, you will know just how debilitating the effects can be. This morning on Doctor's Surgery, we're opening up the lines to you to put your sleep-related questions to our expert, whether it's your partner's incessant snoring, night terrors in your children, sleep deprivation for new parents, or like so many people, if you just can't get to sleep, you can get some expert advice and guidance. Between now and 7 o'clock, our guest this morning is Dr. Dale Ray, Director at Sleep Science at the Sports Science Institute of South Africa at UCT. A very good morning to you, Dr. Ray. Thanks so much for joining us.
Morning, Sarah Jane. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, listen, first of all, why is good sleep so important and how do we get it? That's the $64 million question, isn't it?
Exactly. I wish we could bottle it, but it's not that straightforward. So, I mean, quite simply, there are four main reasons for us to sleep. We need it to survive on one hand. We need it for optimal performance at work. So it's really important for our cognition and our productivity. Of course, it's really important for our long-term physical health. And it's super important for our mental health too.
For a lot of people, though, whilst we might strive to get good sleep, we don't know really what healthy sleep even looks like. We might, as you say, we know what the benefits are now, but what does healthy sleep look like?
There are a couple of things that you can look at to check in whether or not your sleep is healthy. Obviously, you want to be in the ballpark when it comes to sleep duration. It's no good kidding yourself that you think that 4 hours is going to cut it for the next kind of decade or so. So you certainly want to be in the ballpark of 7 to 9 hours for most people in terms of duration. For some people, 6 is okay, and for others, 10 is necessary. But probably more important than that, your sleep needs to be consolidated. So one nocturnal single sleep seems to be the best practice. One shouldn't be too heavily reliant on napping in the daytime, and one certainly shouldn't be reliant on sleeping medication. And then your sleep needs to be as regular as possible. So that speaks to the timing at which we sleep. So in any given week, no more than about an hour and a half variation between earliest and latest bedtime, earliest and latest wake time, and also longest and shortest sleep duration. And then the final thing to consider is that barring any other physical or mental health problems, how do you feel in the daytime? If you are feeling relatively alert and your sleep feels restorative, then probably all is well.
Okay, all right. And then what do we mean when we talk about sleep hygiene? That doesn't mean that you've cleaned your teeth before bed, does it?
So sleep hygiene refers to the practices that we do during the day that set us up for better sleep at night.
Okay.
For people with serious sleep disorders, you can literally hygiene your way into a corner and it's not going to make a difference. And when you have a serious disorder like insomnia or obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy, you certainly need to address the disorder. But it's certainly the sleep hygiene tips and tricks are very useful for the average person out there whose sleep is a little bit errant and who just needs a little bit more structural guidance as to how better to improve their sleep at night. So it really relates to things like when do we stop using screens at nighttime? When should we eat our last meal? How much alcohol is okay for sleep and at what time should we be stopping? Same goes for caffeine. What about exercise? So all the things that we do in the daytime that have an impact to either promote good sleep or impair our sleep. Those are the practices of sleep hygiene.
One of the things that has made me very conscious of sleep hygiene, and as you say, that throughout the day type thing, is having a baby and noticing how what I do during, or what she does during the day, affects sleep at night. And that has been really useful because it's forced me to look at how I behave during the day and my sleep hygiene, which is atrocious, and then how it impacts my own sleep at night. Let's go to some of the questions that are coming in. And we start with Jess in Takai, who says that our three-year-old has been a terrible sleeper from birth. Oh, Jess, I'm so sorry. Which has meant that neither me or my partner have had a good night's sleep for 36 months. Yes, we're counting, says Jess. Oh, dear. SJ, please ask your expert for some help for either us or our son. The sleep deprivation is torture. Oh, dear. Dr. Ray, any advice for either the son or one of those three people needs some assistance?
Oh, Jess, I really feel for you and for your partner and for your little son as well. I mean, that's a long time to be struggling with sleep and to be struggling with sleep deprivation for both of you. And so it really is time, I think, now to seek outside help. There are a number of good companies, like, for example, Good Night Baby, that deals specifically with helping parents manage their children's sleep when they can't get it right. So I would certainly go and look them up and see if you can get them to assist you.
Would that mean, I mean, he's 36, yeah, so he's three. Is three too old to sleep train? And I mean, it's not something I've done, but I know friends of mine who have. Is that something that you're able to do with a three-year-old, Deb?
I think you can sleep train at any age.
Can you?
yeah, absolutely. But I think it just, the key, though, is to figure out why exactly this little guy is struggling to sleep, and then to find the best solution for him, because it might be something physical that's going on with him. It could be a behavioral thing. It might be the sort of setup at home. And I mean, I'm not saying what the reasons are, but I'm saying there's many things that can impair the sleep. And if, I mean, no doubt Jess and her partner have tried everything under the sun and are at their wits' end. Yeah, we must give them absolute credit for that. So really, it's time for someone else to come in, have a look, check out exactly what's going on with your little guy, and to then help you put the structures in place that you need to get him sleeping so that you can sleep, because this is not sustainable.
No, it really isn't. So let's talk about that a little bit from the perspective of Jess and her partner. What are the impacts of long-term sleep deprivation?
So I think Jess will have noticed immediately that one of the first things that happens sort of is related to our cognition. So we're just unable to be productive and sort of on our A game from a getting through life perspective. Obviously, we worry about what happens to our mood, and sort of anxiety and depression can be massively exacerbated by sleep deprivation if there are already an underlying sort of predisposition for those things. But then very importantly, we know that now with chronic sleep deprivation, we become more insulin resistant, which means that we are more likely down the line to develop type 2 diabetes, for example. We struggle with weight more as well. So we find it's much more difficult to shed weight. So there are a lot of metabolic changes that happen. And then down the line, we have an increased risk for heart disease. But I really am speaking down the line now. It's worth paying attention to these things now, for sure.
Is it ever possible to catch up once you're in a sleep deficit?
It's a weird thing to some extent. If we all had to pay back all of our sleep debt, I mean, it would just be ridiculous. No human could do that. Yeah. Where we all have enough sleep debt to make many banks happy, but so that's not going to happen. But we can definitely pay back some of our sleep debt. And sometimes it's a matter of a change in routine, a holiday or something like that, where you actually just get to step away and just crash and sleep for a while. Mm. In other instances, people's bodies actually just crash them, either by making you sick or by asking you to check out from life for a little while. Not so nice, but often that is a way of your body saying, listen, you know, I need to pay back some of this debt. It's pretty serious.
Yeah, absolutely. Di in Newlands has got a question. She says, is catnapping in the afternoon a bad idea? Sometimes I wake up after an afternoon nap feeling absolutely dreadful.
You know, there's so much debate around napping. It's crazy.
Okay.
So, But here's the logic behind napping, and when it's appropriate and when it's not. So the first rule of thumb is that your nighttime sleep has to be as optimal as you can possibly get it before you're allowed to nap. And then there's certain people who get a nap license. New parents, of course, have a nap license. Shift workers.
When you say new parents, how new is new, Dale?
Parents who are still struggling with their kids to sleep.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah, come on. It's a survival mechanism for sure.
Yeah.
Athletes, of course, have a nap license because their sleep need is longer than the average person. And then, of course, when we're sick, we also get a nap license. But and then you need to be careful because if you're doing long sleeps in the daytime, long naps, and anything over an hour is a long nap, then, and certainly 1 to 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours is getting properly long, then you really are at risk of compromising your nighttime sleep. And then you kind of exacerbate this vicious cycle of being dependent on napping because your nighttime sleep's not great. There are cases where that little power nap, that 10 to 15 minute power nap, can be incredibly effective in helping you deal with acute sleep deprivation and just making you have better clarity of mind. And so that can be really, really useful. And so sometimes when we nap in the afternoon and we wake up feeling dreadful, it's usually because we've slept a little bit longer than what we needed and our body's trying to go into a deeper, more restorative sleep at an inappropriate time of day. And now you're asking it to be awake. So that's generally why one feels a bit grotty.
I've always been so envious of people who are able to do true cat naps, like you just said, the 10 to 15 minutes. That is not me. I mean, I suffer with sleep and insomnia and all the rest of it, but I have never, ever been able to be one of those people who says, oh, I'm just going to have a quick shut-eye, 10, 15 minutes, and then sort of leaps up looking fresh as a daisy 15 minutes later. Not me. I'm one of those people who, if I close my eyes in the afternoon, I could happily go through for like 2 or 3 hours, and then, as you say, terrible sleep that evening. Marcus in Benoni, hello Marcus in Benoni, says, I've heard if you have a healthy sleep cycle, you don't need an alarm clock. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. So our bodies love rhythm and routine. They're really routine oriented, and sleep is one of the biggest possible sort of rhythms or routines that we can display. And so when you get yourself into a pattern of healthy sleep, your body and you're waking up at a consistent time every day, your body learns to anticipate that. And it will often alert you and start to rouse you just before your alarm clock would have gone off. And so that's a really nice place to be at. It's super helpful when we want to consistently wake up for work or school at a given time of day, of course. But bear in mind, the flip side of that is that if you get yourself into a pattern where you're regularly waking up at 1, 2, 3 in the morning and then I'm struggling to go back to sleep, that in itself can become a routine. And you've woken at the end of a sleep cycle, and no doubt that's an inappropriate time to be awake, but your body will do it again and again because it thinks it's normal now.
Yeah. If you just tuned in this morning, we're chatting to Dr. Dale Ray, who's the Director of Sleep Science at the Sports Science Institute of South Africa at UCT. We're talking about how to get the best sleep that you can. And if you are someone who is struggling with sleep, maybe you suffer like I do with insomnia, maybe it's restless leg syndrome, maybe you've got a question about something else, anything to do with that. Anything related to sleep or sleep disorders, do get in touch with us on 021 446 0567. You can send a WhatsApp to 072 567 1567, and an SMS to 31567, and put your questions to Dr. Ray. Somebody asking, it's Riaz saying, how can I get my 14-year-old son to stop sleepwalking? He's been doing it pretty much every night since he was 12. We've even moved him to a downstairs bedroom because we were worried he would fall down the stairs. Hey, that's for a lot. What is happening in the brain when we're sleepwalking, Dr. Ray?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's quite a late age for sleepwalking to be persisting to that level. And I would really, I would like to get that checked out. I would suggest that person probably should see a neurologist to make sure. But essentially, when it comes to sleepwalking, it's relatively common in younger children. I mean, I think practically most children will experience at least one episode growing up, and others a couple more. And essentially, you are absolutely asleep still, but you are in what we call non-REM sleep, non-rapid eye movement sleep, where your muscles aren't paralyzed. And so for whatever reason, you start to move around according to what's happening in your head. So it's a relatively common state. Obviously, it shouldn't be. We're not supposed to be walking around while we sleep. But it can certainly be frightening, and it can be relatively... So it's considered a benign condition to some extent. Right. But the problem is that you can put yourself in danger inadvertently.
Absolutely.
And that's why
they've
done.
Move him to a downstairs bedroom. That is extreme. Sure.
Yeah, but it's surprising that the sleepwalking is persisting still at this age, and it would definitely be worth getting that investigated with a neurologist.
Okay, sure thing. Thanks very much for that message, Riaz, and all the very best. Got time for one more question. Sonia in Kells River says, are sleeping pills helpful for insomnia in the long term? I've been on Zopiclone for 5 months, but hate the way my mouth tastes in the morning. Also, they help me to get to sleep, but I often wake up feeling drugged. Please help, says Sonia.
Yeah, great. That's a good question. So sleeping medication is not a long-term solution for a sleep issue. It's designed to be used for a short term. So often, depending on what you're taking, no more than 4 to 6 weeks. And it's designed for an acute bout of insomnia. For example, you might lose a child and be absolutely distraught, and you need to be, you need help to sleep to be able to start to face the new world. So that would be a good example of where a person would be would need to make use of sleep medication. But the plan needs to be 4 to 6 weeks with a wow. defined weaning program and weaning period. The reason we don't like long-term sleeping medication is that it doesn't address the real issue as to why a person's not sleeping. It's a Band-Aid solution. And if you want to have long-term relief, you need to figure out why it is that you're not sleeping and address that. The problem also with many sleeping medications and other sedatives is they interfere with the structure of your sleep, and they have the potential, depending on the medication, to interfere with sometimes how much deep sleep you're getting, and then sometimes even how much REM or rapid eye movement sleep you're getting. And both of those are critical aspects of your sleep for it to be restorative. So it's not a great long-term solution.
And
then,
of course,
many people start...
They?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You start to develop tolerance.
Yeah.
So that means that you need more for it to be effective. And then while some of the newer sleeping medications may not be as physically addictive as the older ones, because some of the older ones are highly physically addictive, they become psychologically addictive.
Sure.
And then once you lose your trust in yourself, your belief in yourself to sleep without medication, that's a very slippery slope to having a long-term problem with sleep, despite using medication.
Yeah. Okay, Sonia, I hope that helps. Dr. Ray's saying that, 4 to 6 weeks, 5 months is probably too long. Dr. Ray, it's been fantastic to have you on. Thank you so much. I'm fascinated by all things to do with sleep, and I hope that you will come and join us again on the show in the future.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolute
Take care.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.